Good afternoon, everyone. Calling to order the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this March 16th, 2015. We have a light quorum, but we do have enough people here to actually open this hearing. We will begin, I think, in a little bit different order. I would like to open a hearing first on House Bill 2819. And this is a bill that deals with driver's licenses for persons 75 years of age and older. And I believe we have Representative Kopp here in the room. And please bring up whoever you like, Representative Kopp. I'll let Patrick give us a little brief opening about what this bill does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2819 requires drivers age 75 years and older to renew their driver license every 4 years and to either take the driving test or submit a certificate from a medical professional affirming that the applicant is capable of safely operating a motor vehicle. We do also have a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment deletes that second provision, the one about allowing a submittal of a certificate from a medical professional in lieu of taking the driving test. We have not received fiscal or revenue impacts in analysis of that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Representative Kopp?
Thank you
for being here today.
Yes, thank you, Chair McCowan. It's really nice to see all of you sitting in this committee and working together.
There will be others.
I know. other people do come. For the record, I'm State Representative Betty Comp, and I'm representing. I represent the communities of Woodburn, Jervis, and North Salem. Today, I am testifying in support of House Bill 2819-1. So we did take out a piece in there about, you know, about people can go to their doctors and get some kind of release, but decided there's better ways and let's just make it clean. At the current moment, the Oregon driver's license for all of us are renewed every 8 years. In later years, due to medical conditions or the general decline of old age, and I turned 65, so I'm now considered old. I don't know why. But
we don't believe that, Representative.
Thank you.
Yes.
Because of age, your vision changes, your general health changes, and my constituents here have a story about how this relates to sometimes 8 years is too long to wait to get your driver's license, and this has led some people to continue driving despite a degenerated vision. My own mother has macular degeneration in her eyes, and it's taken us only 2 years to convince her that she needs to quit driving. It's quite an ordeal to lose that kind of independence that you have at your whole life. You've been driving, but yet when she was driving with one of my brothers in the last 6 months, she goes, well, sometimes I can't tell what side of the road I'm on. And it's like, okay, this is definitely not good. She is 88, so, you know, she's not old. In addition, this bill rectifies the situation by allowing the Department of Motor Vehicles to test people 75 years of age every 4 years, not the 8 years that we currently have in statute. So that's the only change that this makes, and that they would do an on the road test and the vision test, and let's see what else. But the regular tests that we take, all of us, when we take our driving test. Our amended version has removed the medical exemption from this test for driving tests. Behind the wheel tests are important in the renewal consideration. Medical professionals who have signed exemptions would possibly be liable in cases of lawsuits if we had medical professionals taking on that responsibility. So therefore, that's why we took that out of the original bill. And we support the Dash Ones.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
And this is my constituent, Mr.
Bert Horton?
Yeah, Bert Horton. Jeepers. It's been a long Monday, folks.
Thank you, Chairman McCown, and the members of the committee.
It's McEwen.
McEwen.
And you get a pass. Everybody gets a pass.
Once.
Because it happens all the time.
Can I get one?
But I'm trying to get it out there correctly. But thank you so much. And you are, for the record, sir?
My name is Mert Horton. I live in Woodburn, Oregon. I also live in the senior state, which deals with people 55 and older. December, why is that confusing? I did already, I'm sorry. December 21st, 2013, I was involved in a pedestrian auto accident where this woman hit me with her vehicle at such a rate and so hard that it made me go into my Red Ranger pickup and hit so hard that I flew into it and hit my head on the passenger door. I've since then had surgery. I've had acupuncture, everything. I have chronic pain. This lady didn't know she hit me. She had no idea. Her age was 80 years old at that time. Where she's at, I don't know where she's at now. She's moved. Her vehicle's gone. I don't know. Anyway, if there could be something done through the Department of Motor Vehicles and through effective law enforcement that we can get these people in check, because there's so many people that don't want to talk to their mom and dads, mother, fathers, aunts and uncles about giving up driving because she was incapacitated to do so. When she hit me, her whole side of her car was pretty much demolished along with mine, and she did not sway whatsoever. No turn, no evasive maneuver or anything. And when she was asked, she didn't hit anybody, she didn't see anybody. So the Woodburn police showed up, gave them their investigation, the fire department and ambulance showed up. The fire rescue said I was within an inch of dying. And I just want somebody not to go through what I'm doing, not to go through it. I'm a contractor. I'm not a contractor now. I can't do it. My doctor says I can't do it. My independent medical people say I can't do it. I don't know what to do. I love to work. I love to fish, hunt. I can't do any of that now. But if I can get one person to not do what I did, this is going to be great. And I think through this legislation and through your committee, you can help the other Oregonians out there. Number one, not being a victim, not being the perpetrator, because I'm sure she feels guilty as all get out. The insurance company probably is going to be happy because I know her insurance company really just does not love me. And that, what am I trying to say? The most beneficial thing is my family, this is my wife, it's irrevocable what happened to me. I don't know what to do now. I just don't know what to do. But it affects so many people, and the people that those people that don't want, I don't need to stop driving, or, you know, they're 9 years. Oh, we know somebody that's 92. He's passed a couple months ago. He got a license till he was 102, right? 102. And he's sitting there going, I got my license till I'm 102. What's my name? Hand to God, you know. So this is where we have to do something. We have to do something different through the legislature, through DMV. I know it's going to be a little bit of a burden on DMV, but, you know, they're here to help us, I hope.
Well, I appreciate you being here, Mr. Horton, and I'm very sorry that this happened to you. Of course, we all hope that those types of events don't occur. And this is an issue that we've had discussions about in the last session, and I'm sure sessions before I arrived here. This is a very sensitive, difficult issue. My mother-in-law received a renewed license at 90 for 8 years also. I'm very familiar with this process. And I'm just grateful that you took the opportunity to be here to explain to us what happened to you and to draw our attention to the fact that this is a very serious issue. So thank you so much for being here today. Ms. Horton, did you have anything to add while you're here?
I'm sorry.
And your name?
Mm-hmm. I'm Diane Horton, okay. From Woodburn. Thank you for allowing me to speak, Representative McEwen. I'm a crybaby, so.
It's all right. That happens in this building at times. We do it, too, sometimes.
Oh, well, that just shows we're human. Like he said, this has really affected our family. I've never had to work. Ever since this happened to him, I have had to work. And, you know, not that I don't like to work, because I do, but, I mean, that puts a threat on his whole masculinity and all of that sort of thing. You know, he wants to be the man of the house. He doesn't want to be the house husband, you know, and do the grocery shopping and the cooking and that sort of thing, which is what he's been, you know, had to put his life at. You know, he's always been strong and virile, and to not be able to, like, you know, and he didn't say this, but to look at him, he looks just as strong as any of you guys do, you know. But he can't do hardly anything anymore. He can't really even sit for 15 minutes. He can't walk for 15 minutes. You know, he's got so many things wrong with him that, you know, they're like this close to calling him disabled. That happened in his right after his 58th birthday. His whole 59th year was spent going to doctors, surgeons, having surgery. You know, it's not fair that people should. I mean, your driving is a privilege. It's not something that everybody has the right to. You know, it's a privilege, and people need to understand that.
Well, thank you for coming and sharing your story.
Thank you.
We're grateful.
I appreciate it. Thank you, committee.
Panel, do you have questions for this panel?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. When you decided to do this, did you think about maybe a system that, when you talk about at 75, it goes to 4 years, should we also maybe consider at 85 or at 80, maybe we look at 2 years even?
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hack. I looked at several reports, and the 75-year marker was pretty consistent. 10 years ago, it was like 70, but I did not. I thought, well, let's take this one step at a time and see if we can't, get DMV. Because right now, I mean, we don't have a fiscal analysis on this, how much this is going to impact the amount of additional employees that DMV might have. So that was one of the considerations.
I have a follow-up.
Thank you. Yes.
Will they pay? Because the only reason I asked with that, too, is just that at 85 or at 87 or so on, 4 years is, I mean, they're into their 90s, and so I was curious. The other thing is, will they pay a reduced fee then? Mm-hmm. Since it's 8 years now, will it be less for them if it's every four or?
Co-Chair McEwen and Representative Hack, I really appreciate the consideration. That would be my intent. I did not get that in the bill, but if we need to amend that to put it in the bill, that it be the same cost as eight, you know, you take and split it, the 8 year cost and split it in half.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Thank so you. It wouldn't create
thank
an
you.
Additional burden.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Chair. Well, thank you for having the courage to come in. We really appreciate it. Representative, when we've talked about this before over the years, I've always asked if AARP was on board with your bill. That's one question. I have another.
Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, AARP sent us quite a lengthy email about, no, the bottom line is no, they're not on board, although I do have insurance companies that are in support of it.
And Representative Bentz, we do have two AARP representatives that will be on the next panel.
You know, follow up.
Yes.
It seems like a couple of years ago did something to assist in or tighten up, or maybe we just reviewed the law that allows us to report people who are secretly report people who are weaving around and driving badly. And I was just wondering, it seems like that's the 4 years. The 4 years is a long time, so it seems to me a more something we suggest when people come into our law office and are talking about their parents is that they we give them the telephone number, and we say, call this number, and it's the DMV, and they set them up for a test. I'm just wondering if the education piece is something we ought to be emphasizing more about the availability of that approach to this really challenging situation. Because my guess is that the lady that ran into you had already exhibited many signs of not knowing perhaps how badly she had diminished, if you will. But that might be one thing. And then one last thing, Madam Chair, that the problem in my part of the world, which is over on the eastern part of the state, is there's no alternative to driving. And so people don't dare quit driving because they would have to move to town, and most of them don't want to. So this is very difficult bill to support given the lack of any alternatives. So I don't know what the solution is to that particular problem.
Can I respond?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Rep. McEwen and Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, I really appreciate what you're saying about just driving in particular, and the example with my mother, I did not know that we could call a DMV and request, well, or however there's a process to retest, because I mean, literally, until she was driving with one of my brothers and said, I sometimes don't know what side of the road I'm on, then, you know, all the caution lights went out. And so we didn't even consider doing that. So that I really appreciate what you're saying. And she, too, lives in the country, and it's not very far into the community, but it has isolated her now that she doesn't have her driver's license. There are true consequences on the other side. So we ask you to consider what those options are, and yet public safety is very, very important, too. So it is a tough issue, and I thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Thank you very much to you. Next, I'd like to call up John Bartholomew and Jim Botwinis. Am I pronouncing that correctly, sir? Thank you. Thank you for being here to join our committee this afternoon.
Thank you.
In any order that you like.
Well, I'll start off and say just a few words. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, I am John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And I want to start by saying that I very much commend the supporters of this legislation for their interest in making sure that driving is safe for all Oregonians. I mean, it's an absolutely critical issue. We've been doing a great job reducing the number of accidents, improving safety over the years, and we're on a good trend line there. But there's always more that we can do, and I'm very sorry to hear what happened to the Hortons. You know, it's something that all too many of us have had some incident with being hit by a driver of any age. So, but I did want to note for the record that, so I submitted a report to the record from House Bill 3185 from the year 2011. That bill created a work group to examine just this issue, and it involved a number of experts from a number of places, the DMV, Department of Transportation, medical professionals, AARP was involved in the process as well, driver safety experts. And they found that the medically at-risk program that we have that Representative Bentz mentioned is working pretty effectively, and but required some tweaks, which were done in the subsequent session. But there's also no evidence that shows that people who are older are actually worse drivers. In fact, it kind of exposed that the contrary is more accurate. So while this is a well-meaning piece of legislation, it kind of misses the mark. So I would like to turn this over now to Mr. Botwinis, who's our expert on driver safety, and he can probably answer any questions better than I can.
Great. Thank you for being here, sir.
Madam Chair, person, members of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, good afternoon. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm here on behalf of AARP Oregon in opposition to House Bill 2819. I'm also a district coordinator for Marion Polk and Yamhill County, trainer and instructor for the AARP Driver Safety Program. I've been doing that for close to 2 years now. And I also retired from law enforcement about 11 years ago. When I read the bill, there were three questions that kind of came to mind. Why 75? And doesn't every licensed driver, regardless of their age, have a responsibility to drive safely? And doesn't everyone have a right to travel our highways safely, regardless of our age? Oregon currently has a law on the books that requires persons 50 years of age or older to come into DMV in person to renew your driver's license. And the main reason for that is to have your vision checked. I would hope that DMV employees have been trained to spot folks who have been, who either have some form of impairment or cognitive impairment at that time when they're coming in to renew, and would maybe question whether that person should have their license renewed or not. And basically we're talking about people from 50 years of age, not 75. I've reviewed a lot of the information that I could find on drivers 75 and older, and there isn't any indication that because we're 75, we're a less safe driver than somebody who is younger. In fact, there's lots of data to show that drivers that are in the 18 to 24 year age of a bracket cause many, many crashes. Many crashes. We also have a number of laws on the book about distracted driving to keep us from being involved in crashes. But it seems, regardless of those laws, how many people today still use their vehicles as mobile beauty salons, restaurants, libraries, concert halls, watch them texting and talking while they're driving down the highway? I see it almost every day. It's just amazing, and it's amazing to watch those folks driving. How many folks do you really see at the age of 75 plus doing those kind of things? They're more intent on driving their cars than they are doing things that they're not supposed to do in their car. Do older drivers have some issues that can affect, that can impact them? Yes, absolutely. Medications, reduced mobility, reduced hearing, reduced vision. But it doesn't just apply to people who are 75 years of age or older. It applies to many people that are much younger than 75. They exist. And the number of driver safety classes that I've taught, it's amazing to me how many of the participants have openly voiced that they know that their driving abilities have changed, and they self-regulate themselves in the respect of they don't drive at night anymore, they avoid commute hours, they avoid heavy traffic, they avoid busy highways. They're already in kind of this mode of self-regulating themselves. If we want to regulate folks, shouldn't those regulations apply to everybody that has a driver's license, regardless of our age? And simply because we're older doesn't make us unsafe. And again, the numbers don't show that we're unsafe because we're 75 plus. I've seen people personally who appear to be 10 to 15 years younger driving cars that probably shouldn't be driving a car, but they are. And as stated earlier, let's not get started on the younger drivers and their driving behaviors. We've all seen them, and we know what they do. What might be an appropriate process is to require folks who receive X number of traffic citations or are involved in X number of crashes in a 12-month period of time, require them to attend a driver safety / education course. And it needs to be a class certified by DMV. They receive a certificate saying that they completed the course. And apply that to everybody so that we're keeping the road safe for everybody, not just on how old a person may or may not happen to be. Also, in regard to when I teach my classes, we talked about the medically at-risk program and folks being able to report. I keep on my table the DMV request form to have people retested. And it's amazing how many of those forms leave my back table. So I'm, at least as an instructor, trying to make that very aware that that is an option for people to use for maybe somebody they know as a friend. Maybe they still have a mom or a dad that's still living that they think shouldn't be driving. Maybe they have a sibling that they think shouldn't be driving. All I know is that the forms leave my classroom when the class is over with. I don't particularly think that this bill does anything to address the problems with drivers of any age. Most of us in this room will be 75 someday. Do we want to have somebody tell us that we have to do something because we turn 75, or do we do something because we really should not be on the road, no matter what our age is? And as stated earlier, this bill, to me, I've reviewed House Bill 3185 and the work group efforts that were put together, and it certainly appears to be contrary to what that work group did. Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify. AARP Oregon would respectfully request that this not receive a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair. And this might actually be for maybe Amy or some of the officers in the back, but as I understand it, we still have police officer capabilities also to have people retested if they exhibit perhaps bad driving that they see. I know we had that when I was a Portland police officer, and I did that a few times, filling those forms out. So I assume so that is still there. Okay. So thank you.
You bet. Another question. Mr. Botwinis, this is such an important issue for me. My father's 93. As I mentioned, my mother-in-law received her 8-year license when she was 90, and she drove very well till she was 90. And there was a point right after that there was a precipitous downturn in her capabilities, and we were able to work with her and with her physician to convince her that this was an appropriate move for her to limit her driving. We actually had the same issue with my father, and in conjunction with his physician and my sister's, when it became apparent that his abilities were diminishing, we were able to work with him to get him to stop driving. And it's very difficult, and it's very personal to a family when those events occur. I'm not as concerned about these issues because we were driving with them, we were observing them, we worked with them very carefully to help them through this transition into a different phase of their life where they no longer drove, and we were neighbors, so it made it much easier. I've been hit by an 82-year-old who should not have been driving, broadsided a few years ago, and her family had been trying to work her through that process unsuccessfully till she ran into me and a very kind police officer that was the end of her driving capability. And unfortunately, it happened a little bit late. I just think this is an incredibly serious issue. I take to heart what you've said. I've read the conclusions of the report that was done recently, and I'll quote, "Establishing license renewal or testing requirements based solely on age cannot be supported by any evidence." So what you're saying is documented, that age is not inherent in making, you know, 75, it's arbitrary. 75 is very arbitrary. But I also understand that how we as a society try and figure out where that point is important. And, you know, self-regulation is great, and we hope everybody does it. I hope I will have the courage when I hit that point where I realize that I'm not safe anymore, that I can limit myself. But a lot of people don't. And I don't know where that sweet spot is. We've had this conversation in our last session. We're going to have it this session. We'll probably have it again and again and again because there's no perfect answer here. But we do have a number we can call. We can work with our physicians and when our families appear to be exhibiting behavior that may want you begin to think that this is the time. But I got to tell you, this is a tough one for all of us that have lived it. Representative Benson.
I'm sure, forgive me for asking you another question, but I was going to say I was looking at the Consumer Reports article here, and it says teenagers and older people are the riskiest drivers. And it says, mile for mile, the crash rate for drivers aged 16 and 17, 9 times as high as that for middle-aged drivers. People 80 and older are involved in 5.5 times as many fatal crashes per mile driven as middle-aged drivers. Now, I'm guessing that the response is that this because they're older and feebler and they get killed more frequently when they are in a wreck. But I looked at 3 articles while I was sitting here, and it does appear that, according to the graphs here, that there is a problem. And I'm just wondering if AARP is engaging in what all of us do when our parents come in, and that's denial. And so maybe you can share with us what you are doing to try to help. And it sounds like you have an education class and you are doing other things aggressively to try to take care of this problem, because as someone over 60, me, I anticipate that this is going to be happening soon enough when my kids come in and say, gee, Dad, get a bicycle, or whatever they're going to say to me.
Yeah.
But it would be great if you maybe you could just quickly list for us what it is exactly that you're doing to address this issue.
Well, Chair McEwen, Representative Benz, besides having the driver safety program as one of our premier programs that we have available out in the community, we utilize our vast membership base, how everybody gets a magazine. We frequently have articles on how to talk to your loved one about driving, how to identify yourself, what your capabilities are. So we do a lot of public education work, both in the magazine, online, in many different ways. And we are open to any kind of conversations about ways that we can improve all of that as well. Do you have anything to add?
Representative McHugh and Representative Benz, all of us as instructors, we're all trained the same. We're all trained to teach the class, in essence, the same way. And because I'm a district coordinator, I get the opportunity to evaluate some of our instructors, and I'm certainly not seeing any of them teaching much different than I do. We all have our own little unique ways of doing things, but the basic information gets out, and I know that most of us spend a lot of time when we're teaching about independence. I always ask my class folks, what's the single biggest fear you have if you couldn't drive anymore? And somebody will always crop up and say, I will lose my independence, which opens the door wide open for me to be able to talk about that issue. Yes, it is a lack of independence if you're not able to drive at all, but in reality, it's no different than from the day we were born until the day we pass. Our independence changes constantly, and we always figure out how to deal with that change in independence. No matter whether we're 15, whether we're 25, 35, 45, 55, we always figure out how to deal with that change in our independence. We talk about different forms of transportation modes. We talk about if you're a person who has trouble seeing at night, maybe you should consider not driving at night. If heavy traffic bothers you, maybe you shouldn't drive in heavy traffic. If driving on the freeway bothers you, drive on roads that don't have such high speeds. And most of them seem to take that to heart.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both very much for your testimony. I'm just struck by this is not an issue considered in isolation in simply one state, and I don't have the work group study pulled up, but it might behoove you to look at some of the before and afters from other states and countries that have done this. And I'll just reference, as I've been doing a little research on my phone here, along with Representative Benz, in the Danes, actually, a Danish study indicated that when they put in yearly renewals more frequent renewals after 70 and annual renewals after 80, there was no change in fatalities from driving in the age groups before and after those groups, before and after those ages. And in fact, there was an 11-fold increase in death of seniors who were forced to use other modes of transportation because of presumably the unfamiliarity with it or more pedestrian deaths. So it just strikes me that we often consider this in isolation, and this is probably a debate that's raging around the world And I think it's also a debate that has been substantially changed, frankly, by texting and driving in the last 10 years. Whereas we may have seen perhaps a correlation more with experience in driving and age and cognitive ability, the rise in texting and driving in the last 10 years probably throws a complete anvil in those statistics because of the prevalence of younger drivers who text and drive more. So anyway, I just appreciate your testimony, and I think it's easy to potentially legislate just from an idea or what we think is common sense, but there's a substantial body of data out there that could support what we might choose to do here.
No comments for this panel. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
An important topic. We also have Amy Joyce and Lana Butterfield who would like to speak to this issue.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. You know, the debate we've already had in committee points up the fact that this is a very difficult concept, a very difficult topic. It's a bill every session. I deal with constituent cases on this topic all the time, so it's a difficult problem. Difficult nut to crack. It's been something that the legislature has looked at over and over. The panel before me talked about the work group that was put together under legislation passed in 2011. Prior to that, there was a major change to the program in 2001 and 2003 after legislation in 99, legislation again in 2001. Legislation again in 2003 and significant rule writing around this topic. And in 2003, the state went to a program that is based on impairment, not on a specific diagnosis. Before that, it was not based on age at all, but you could have a particular diagnosis and that would qualify you for immediate suspension of driving privileges. So the change under the at-risk driver program, that is the current statute that DMV implements, has two parts to it. That is the mandatory program in which a person's primary care physician must report a person who they deem to meet certain criteria in terms of cognitive or physical conditions that make it unsafe for that person to drive. So there are extensive administrative rules at what point the person reaches where the primary care physician must report the person to DMV. The typical reaction to one of those mandatory reports is a nearly immediate suspension. The person is given an opportunity to ask for a contested case hearing, submit additional medical information to DMV. DMV employs physicians called medical determination officers that assist in the analysis of these cases. So that's what happens there. There is the non-mandatory portion. Vice Chair Gorsuch was getting a little bit to this. This is basically that just about anybody could report another person if they have concerns that that person should no longer be driving or maybe should be retested. So this could be a medical provider other than a primary care physician. It might be a law enforcement officer. It might be a family member, a friend, a neighbor. But when that non-mandatory report is received and the program manager looks at it and with the assistance of these medical determination officers make a decision about whether perhaps the person should be retested or they need to receive additional medical information. The typical response to that is not an immediate suspension, but perhaps a notification of the person that you need to come in and retest one of the three tests DMV gives: vision, knowledge, or the behind-the-wheel test. So any person, a family member, law enforcement, can report this person to DMV, and that triggers certain actions. Again, if the person is suspended, they have the opportunity for an administrative hearing. They can submit additional medical information. Perhaps the condition clears or the physical impairment goes away or is corrected. So there are all kinds of ways we get through this. But that program, again, assessed after House Bill 3185 in 2011, that panel of a lot of medical experts and people with expertise in this area came to the conclusion that the program works very well. It's considered a model across the country because it looks at impairment, not at age, not at diagnosis, but the actual impairment that affects a person's driving abilities. So that is the program that is on the books today. Panel in 2011 found that it works well. Some small changes were made to the program based on those recommendations. But we continue forward with the at-risk driver program that's in place today. And as an aside, as the first panel noted, changes in terms of accelerated testing, particularly with the Dash 1 amendment that would get rid of the possibility of a medical certification and just go to strictly everybody's going to get tested, it's going to be a significant impact on the agency. That's what I have.
Thank you, Ms. Joyce. Ms. Butterfield, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today on behalf of American Family Insurance Company. American Family would like to support this bill with the addition of the amendment that we requested from Representative Comp, and we thank her and the requesters of the bill. We are just saying that if you agree, people over 75 should be checked from time to time to make sure they can still drive, that a driving test is the best indicator, that people could easily go and get a note from the doctor that a driving test is just better. American Family is sending me a copy. They did an internal review of their loss ratios and by age, and it's a very interesting chart. It shows you that once drivers reach age 70, their riskiness and chance of loss increases with age. It appears that the increase is pretty steep after age 75. Now, they sent me a chart which has loss ratio on it, and they didn't want me to show that to anybody else because it might affect their competitiveness. They have pretty good rates. But to look at that is interesting because it shows that at age 80, the loss ratio for that age of drivers is 20 to 30 points higher than any other age. So as soon as I get that chart, I will send it to Patrick and he can distribute it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Joyce, I'm reading the report, or I'm actually looking at a consumer report, and it says currently 28 states plus the District of Columbia have special provisions for renewing the license of older drivers. Do you know if anybody else has arbitrarily picked an age?
Chair McEwen, as part of that task force that looked at this in 2011, they did an analysis of each of the other states' provisions. That's part of the report. We can get that to you.
I think it's up on OLIS. We have it here in front of us. Yeah.
One thing to pay attention to when you look at those is that some states will go to a more frequent renewal, but it's a renewal by mail. And so the person isn't coming in and there's no additional testing. So just be cautious when you look at those to know for sure what is actually happening at that accelerated renewal, whether it's actually getting you any bang for that buck.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And I believe we have exhausted our witness list for this bill. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2819 and open a hearing on which way are we headed, Mr. Brown? House Bill 2282, please. And I would like to call up Molly McGrew and John Brueggemann, please. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Brennan, would you like to give us the highlights?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will dispense with the reading of what the original bill does. The original bill is a placeholder. So the Dash 2 amendment, which you have in front of you, replaces the original measure. It allows the Department of Transportation to receive electronically transmitted documents necessary to do several different transactions. I'll let the witnesses at the table discuss them.
All right.
Thank you. Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Molly McGrew. I'm with State Street Solutions, and I'm here today on behalf of my client, Motor Vehicle Software Corporation. And next to me here is John Bergerman, the Executive Vice President for MVSC. We are here in support of House Bill 2282-2 amendments. I'll turn it over to him to explain the context of where the Dash 2 amendments come from in the bill in itself. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Brueggemann with Motor Vehicle Software Corporation. And we're excited to say that we are opening a local business here in Portland to do the electronic registration title work for auto dealers, fleet companies, financial institutions, things like that. So their typical DMV needs, we move all that stuff electronically for them. And the direction that this sort of work is going around the country, obviously when it comes to e-government and the government space, everyone would like to do things more electronically. Let's get rid of paper. Let's do things like this. The real challenge to do that when it comes to the motor vehicle space for years has been the requirement by NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, that upon transferring a title, you have to sign physically a statement declaring the odometer, the number on the odometer, because that's obviously directly tied to the vehicle's value. So that's something that's been in place. Now, in the 2011 highway reauthorization, Congress directed NHTSA to develop standards for electronic signature because this is the way that every industry is going. And so finally this year, I believe in March or April, they should have draft guidance with final rule in place at the end of the year. So our job is on behalf of our clients, which are auto dealers, folks like that, is to do everything we can to make their lives simpler. And with our DMV partners, the folks that we work within the state, to make their life easier, to reduce their costs. So this is sort of, as we move into the Oregon market and establish an operation here and begin to serve the Oregon consumers, we want to do that electronically if at all possible. So we're kind of preemptively understanding where the feds are going, and we want to make sure that we are able to do all this work electronically if possible.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question in regards to the work that you want to bring to Oregon. Is it specifically stated in the contract that the work that's created from the software, those jobs, that they will be brought to Oregon and held here in Oregon?
It's not, in fact. So the way it's structured with us, we'll have a contract with the DMV, but the contract is so that it defines the scope of what we may do. Our work actually is, we're paid by the dealerships themselves and the consumers themselves. But for example, right now there's one current provider in the state. We will be the second provider in the state. But in every state that we operate in, like in Oregon, we will have, in fact, we put in a bid today on an office. All of the staff that relates to Oregon work is based in Oregon. So the IT development, the administrative staff, things like that, all of that's done here. Now, the headquarters of the company is in Los Angeles, but everything that we do in every state that we go is locally based, because if you look at, and not to get into the competitive landscape, but our nearest competitor doesn't have any staff in the state to do exactly this. And that's quite frankly why we typically clean their clock wherever we go, because we locate and we have that domain expertise locally. Because if you're not right there working with your clients every day of the week, and if you don't understand the specific rules of how the DMV works and how the business processes work in each state, you're just not going to be successful, and people aren't really going to adopt the services. So for all intents and purposes, we are a national company, but everywhere we go, we have a completely locally staffed office.
Follow up?
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. When I heard about this and met with some folks, my biggest concern, and I talked to Amy too early on, is that I want to see the opportunity given to local Oregon companies. And I love that you're confident, and I certainly hope that this product is what you're saying that it is. But given the fact that you say that it needs to be local in order to be successful, is there an issue with adding that to the contract so that Oregonians feel secure in knowing that those jobs will be here? Because oftentimes we contract with companies that are out of state to do state work, and those jobs don't end up being here. And so I'm just extremely sensitive that we keep Oregon dollars in Oregon and we let those folks have jobs because we need them. And so is there an opportunity to add that to the contract. If what you're saying is correct, that the work needs to be done in this state in order for you to be successful, would there be an issue in adding that to the contract?
Well, the contract, the way the contract is structured, says that you have to have a local office, local operation. Now, that's, there can be a wide variety of how that's interpreted, I suppose, by people who do business. Originally, when we were interested in doing business in Oregon, the state had an exclusive contract with one provider. And so in our point is you should have an open market, that anyone who wants to provide services should be able to provide services. You know, should have an open process, which is the way it works in most states. There's an open process. If you meet the specifications, if you meet the qualifications, you can sign up, build software, and do business. And that's the environment that we like, because we like a healthy, competitive marketplace. And so we don't have a problem with that at all. In fact, so when the system was changed to allow us in, it also opened it up, paved the way for anyone else who wants to do business to come behind us and do that. So there will be, I see probably a number of businesses that will be able to do this in the future. It's not, I will say, it's not an easy thing to get into, because, I mean, the lines of code, the, you know, we're dealing with millions and millions of lines of code. We're dealing with interfacing with each, you know, rental car fleet, you know, company. We have dedicated interfaces to all of the states and all of the clients that we work with. So it's a massive engine that we work with.
So was that a yes? There's not a
yes.
problem with adding that to the
yes.
contract, that any job that you do here in Oregon and you create in Oregon will stay in Oregon?
Yes. Yeah.
So I know that there were 10 people or something that they said they just employed. So I think that's great. Love that you're willing to do that. And I certainly appreciate that. And that's something that we can take back to our constituents when they say, hey, we have a California company doing DMV software mm-hmm. work. It'd be nice to say, but these many jobs were created by that.
Mm-hmm. We're a registered business in the state of Oregon, and we are an Oregon. Our Oregon operation is an Oregon and will always be an Oregon business.
Okay. And you're willing to amend that contract to read that?
Yeah, we haven't. We're,
I like that.
That'll come out in the negotiation. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that very much.
Okay. Representative McLean.
Well, I'm a beginner, you know, and so today it just all gets me.
And you're entitled.
Okay. Well, first of all, I know that the connecting clause that I see in front of me has to be the widest connecting clause in the whole world to put anything in it, okay? So I get that. I understand that legislative process here. But then I read down and look at all of the results, and I look at the bill, and I still have that clause on the piece of legislation. How does that work?
Patrick?
Oh, Madam Chair, so the relating clause issue, yes.
It's called a gut instinct.
Yeah, our committee during the interim introduced a number of bills that had relating clauses that were very broad for just this type of
25
situation.
25 of them.
Yes.
We can thank Representative Reed for that. Yes.
Yes. In this case, this is an issue that they had, but did not have a legislative concept vehicle to put it into.
Okay.
And so we selected one that ours fit. It ended up being a very broad one, but it fits that one. So that's the reason that the relating clause is very broad on that.
Okay, but it still has to make sense. I mean, the words have to make sense.
And the part that makes sense is the amendment.
Right. Okay, so the amendment
dash
makes
two
sense.
Amendments.
The dash two amendments is just this gut and stuff thing.
It's a
okay.
gut and stuff. So should we decide to move forward with this, we will accept the dash two amendment, which will become the bill,
yes.
which then has the appropriate relating to clause.
Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the amendment then, if that's okay.
There you go.
All right. So
thank you.
I just want to understand that. So I get that DMV wants to do more things electronically. And so they have chosen you, or are you meeting the standards for them on the basic level, and now you're doing more work for them to make sure that your program is going to do the things they need you to do? Or is this something that you do in every state and it's all the same?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, and sorry for not going through the chair earlier. I forget my legislative procedure sometime. It's been a while. Every state does it a little differently. Mm-hmm. Back to Representative Hack's point, that's why we have local expertise in this. Some states simply have an open process where you simply meet the standards and, you know, you have to tie into their database, their mainframe or database or whatever architecture that they have in place, and provide services. So in the case of Oregon, what previously there was an exclusive contract for one provider. And I think that was partially done because Oregon may not be the biggest market in the world, and who knows how many people want to come in. But it was then expanded, and we recently won a competitive bid, not for or a competitive application
okay,
process. So what we won was the ability to be the first to integrate with the state.
Okay.
Now, there will be others who are qualified behind us that will come after us.
Okay.
But we won a competitive process to be the best to integrate first. So that's, and then the contract will define the scope of what we can do. So we can do initial registrations, entitling of vehicles, and transfers of vehicles, things like that.
And you, and this contract will have deliverables and it'll have dates.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, yes, for the build period of our while we're building in constructing actually into the mainframe, we'll have dates, deliverables, timelines, things like that. And then on an ongoing basis, the work that we do is continually audited. So the state's looking at to making sure that, because we will actually handle license plates as well and stickers, so that we're tracking all that inventory, that everything, all the paperwork that's required to, you know, from the dealerships, or hopefully the lack of paperwork, but the imaging that's done will then be looked at, audited, to make sure that we're in compliance with the DMV's rules.
Okay.
And did you have another follow-up?
No, I don't.
Okay. Are we complete? All right. Thank you very much. I think we have two more people signed up to testify, Ms. Joyce and Mr. Dewey.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Just a little bit of quick background on the program that John is talking about. This is an electronic vehicle registration. So this is not, perhaps you've heard about the system transformation that we'll be talking about in the ways and means process. This is a very discrete sort of a application that has to do with dealerships when they electronically submit documents to DMV on behalf of their customers. So that's the interface we're talking about. I guess otherwise I'm just here to answer any questions. The Dash 2 amendment, Ms. McGrew was kind enough to work with us on that, and I think DMV is fine with the outcome on the Dash 2.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and Amy, thank you very much. So do you expect the study of speed bumps to be submitted electronically?
Chair McEwen, Representative Davis, will be carving that into concrete in the form of a speed bump. And
thank you.
That via Mr. Brennan.
And there may be many more to come, I might add.
Hey, I've been clicking them off here. So.
Here Mr. go. Dewey, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, Mike Dewey, on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Usually you get Tom Gallagher here, my former business partner, but he decided to play golf every day.
Avoiding the speed bumps.
Yes, for him. Ms. Berry, who works with me, I said I had another bill, and I'm interested in 2282. Let me know when it comes up. And she came to find me and said, speed bumps? What are we doing with speed bumps? We didn't have that conversation.
Okay.
So because the relating clause was something that we thought was useful, we have an amendment, a draft amendment before you for your consideration, and I'll explain that. The auto dealers support this bill. We want to do as much electronically as we possibly can to provide the best service to the customer that purchased a vehicle used or new. So we think this makes a whole lot of sense. So what we have before you, and we're working with DMV on this to make sure we get the wording correctly, is an opportunity, and other states have this, Washington, California, almost all states have what we would call an administrative fee to do more than just what is required today by the statute, which is preparing the documents for the ownership of the vehicle, titling of the vehicle, the plates and the like, and that's in the statute. And then there's a fee that's set for that, and the DMV, as I understand, has an advisory committee of dealers, a vast number of dealers in the transportation arena that talk about items like this. And so this is an administration fee that is followed after Washington. So, for example, we would be preparing and titling or filing traditional ownership documents, perfecting, releasing, or satisfying liens or other security interest, temporary permit liability insurance, verification of insurance for title and registration purposes, tracking loss, faulty, or out-of-state titles.
So just to be up front with you, this would be a new fee that a car dealer could provide in the ownership of a car, new or used. And this would be either electronically through an integrator, or some of them still do paper. But because of these or other services that we do, we think we're precluded from charging because we can only charge for documents that are associated specifically for DMV. So that's what we want to suggest to you. And because this has come late in the sense that we've talked to the sponsors about the bill, and we would consider this a friendly amendment, but I did say that if for some reason you have a different choice, we would find another vehicle, no pun intended, on that. So that's what it does, and I'm happy to come around and talk to you further about why this is, we think, an important bill.
I believe Vice Chair Davis has a question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Mike, for your testimony. As I'm reading through the proposed language, some of these items do appear to be items that are interactions with DMV. For instance, verifying clearing titles, perfecting and releasing liens, all of which are held at DMV. So how would that, you're interpreting that as not already covered under sub 3A, may charge a purchaser of a vehicle fee for the preparation of documents?
Madam Chair, Representatives, that's a good question. That's why we're still working through exactly what would be applicable for the administration fee.
Okay.
So I look at some of this, and I'm just wondering if it's covered under the actual documents that we prepare.
Mm-hmm.
And the Washington law doesn't quite follow. It speaks to an excise tax that we took out and the like. So we're going to work with the parties just to make sure we get it right in terms of what's included.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Chair. Mike, if you could go back and say again, how's the fee going to be established? What's the amount of the fee?
Well, it's a very interesting statute. The statute is, I want to say, 50 and 75 is where it starts. And I believe today it's $100 and $75. If you use an integrator, it's $100. If you don't, it's 75. That's my recollection.
Could you follow up?
Yes.
That's the floor.
That's the floor.
That's the least that can be charged.
That is true based on the statute.
But this is not set forth in rule, is it? I'm trying to figure out, will this be in rule, or is this whatever somebody wants to charge?
This will be, my understanding, based on the other parts of the statute, it will be in rule. And that would be our, what we would intend. The party, we would think it was DMV, would set what that they thought was appropriate based on the administrative work to be done.
Yes.
And Mike, I'm still not hearing the answer. Perhaps Amy can give it, but will there be an administrative rule that says the fee shall not exceed for each of these services X, or will it be left up to the dealer to add in whatever they like?
Madam Chair, if I hear your question correctly, what our intent is we would have a conversation, the industry, consumer groups and the like, whoever's there, they would ultimately, we have these floors, and we're at 175. We would, I assume, come in and say, here's what we think is the appropriate fee for us to charge. And that would be the fee that would be that would be what we'd be charging.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
That would be the fee that would go into the administrative rule.
Yes. That's our intent.
Thank you.
And I believe based on my discussion with legislative counsel, I could be wrong, is that by virtue of the way the statute's set up, DMV already sets the fee on the document side, and they would have the authority based on the statute to do it on the administrative side.
Thank you.
We have Representative Hack and then Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bentz asked all of my questions, so of course, thank you so much. Thank you, Mike, for clarifying that. That's important. And on the back to the software overall issue, I get this isn't your big package, but I'm still going to beat the drum on the keeping it in Oregon. So I still want to do that. So, but I do get it's not your overall package. I understand that this is just a very small piece, but and I appreciate the willingness to take a look at that. So thank you for indulging me on that.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And Mike, thanks for the follow-up. Anytime we're asked to authorize a fee, I think the question is, what's the service being rendered in return? And so in this instance, if you need more time to talk to your members, that's fine. If a fee were authorized here, would consumers be provided with a service that they cannot currently obtain or don't currently get?
Madam Chair, let me go back just to be sure. That's a good question. We just started this conversation a few days ago,
sure,
so I'd like to be able to go back and make sure that we're adding the value that needs to be added in terms of the discussion you have as you're working through the purchase of a vehicle and everything that goes with it. I would say that 3 months ago I bought a new vehicle, and I expected to be there for quite some time, but I was very impressed with how quickly we could get through the papers in terms of electronically, so I was happy to be there. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was a nice day, and I'd just soon be somewhere else.
Ms. Joyce, I'm not on the IT caucus for a reason. This is not my area of expertise, but does your platform that you have in existence right now manage this paperless configuration well, or are you dependent upon us moving into
the dinosaur?
A new world so that we can manage this?
So, Chair McEwen, keeping the two amendments separate for a moment, the electronic vehicle registration system that Mr. Brueggemann is talking about and the Dash 2s are about, there is the ability to do this interface now. This integrator system has been in place for something like 10 years. But in terms of the Dash 2, the ability to receive electronic documents, electronic signatures, some of that is not there yet. So this the proposal under the Dash 2 would make clear in statute that when we get there, we can put those things into place and be able to use them legally. On the Dash 3, this kind of the fee, that's kind of a separate issue in terms of, the dealers are doing the work and you know, should they be allowed to charge a fee for two separate pieces of work that they're doing. So we'd need some help, yes, to be able to receive some of these things electronically.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
I am going to, let's see, I think we've exhausted our witness list for this hearing. I will close the hearing on 2282, and we are moving on. Mr. Brennan, are we in the proper order here? Okay. I will open a hearing on House Bill 3005. We have Representative Wilson here. Welcome to our committee, Representative Wilson.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here. I'll reward your patience before. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Carl Wilson, State Representative, House District 3. Wanted to bring to you a simple little bill that I trust will be just that, but if it's not, well, that's why we have public hearings, I guess. I want to talk about House Bill 3005. This comes to me via a good lifelong friend of mine who is a missionary in Africa and has been for many years, yet he remains a resident of Grants Pass. House Bill 3005 is modeled after ORS 807.135, which allows that a license held by a member of the Oregon National Guard or a military reservist ordered on active duty and deployed to a location outside the United States that expires while the holder is on active duty shall remain valid and grant driving privileges for 90 days following the termination of that active duty. So this bill would essentially extend that same courtesy to Oregonians who are performing services outside the United States on a volunteer basis for a nonprofit, religious, charitable, or a relief organization. You'll notice in the bill it has the language whether or not such persons receive meals or lodging or reimbursements or vouchers for meals or lodging or expenses. The reason that that is included, it's intended to emphasize that although somebody might get meals or other expenses covered, they are still overseas in a voluntary capacity. So again, the bill, which I believe to be simple, just simply extends the courtesy to those individuals I mentioned previously, extends that same privilege that folks currently in the Oregon National Guard or other military reservists receive.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Wilson?
Makes sense.
Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you bringing this bill to us. How does it work in practice? So you get pulled over, your license is expired. You just say, I swear I was volunteering in Central Africa.
Yeah, well, it's Chair, or Madam Chair, and to Vice Chair Davis. Right now, as it's currently described, in fact, as you look at the bill, going down to line 14, it indicates that the officer has every opportunity and will more than likely cite you for an expired license, but you'll get your opportunity in court to make that verification before the court, just as the military will be able to show when they got off active duty or released from active duty. I'm not sure what will happen here, but I would imagine a mission board will vouch the same way for their employee here, if I can call the individual an employee. I expect it to go the same way. So in all likelihood, they can be cited for no license, but they'll get their opportunity in court to reverse that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Chair, thank you very much, and happy early St. Patty's Day, at least to several of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? All right, thank you. Then I will close the hearing on House Bill 3005 and open a hearing on House Bill 2810. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2810 exempts certain electric vehicles from requirements to have two registration plates. It has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. We also have a dash one amendment which specifies the same exemption under a different ORS than the one in the original bill.
Thank you, and welcome back, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. It's like old home day here at the Transportation Committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, state rep from House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, bringing you what I hope is a simple bill. Actually, we want the dash one, so you can skip the rest of the bill and look strictly at the dash one.
Thank you.
Bringing this bill forward on behalf of my constituent who's here with me. Who brought to my attention that as the technology in our electric vehicles continues to change, manufacturers are not interested in leaving space for a front plate, and yet the fine for not having one is about, I think it's
$160.
Fine, and so this would exempt from a fine electric vehicle who is not able to display a front plate because the manufacturer does not provide a means to display that registration plate. About 20 other states, as you'll hear, have this type of exclusion, and particularly as we're looking at seeing more of these vehicles on the road, the ability to make sure that we aren't just nickeling and diming taxpayers with fines on license plates. I know that there's certainly a good reason for front plates. We don't use them for motorcycles, but the ability to make sure that these cars work and are operable the way that they need to be, and that front plate in some of these newer cars with new technology is a hindrance. So I want to turn it over to my constituent, who will certainly articulate the need, and I'll sit here and wait and answer any questions at the end.
Great. Thank you, Representative Parrish. Mr. McGuire, I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair McCown.
Actually, I'm going to do one more time. It's McEwen. I'm trying to educate the populace here.
You know, I have a friend who has spells the name the same way, and he calls it McCown.
It can be McEwen, too, depending on where you live. But for this purpose, it's McEwen, so thank you for indulging me.
Well, and I hope that I don't do it again, but it might be compulsory.
It's hard.
My name is Brian McGuire, and I'm a constituent of Representative Parishes, and I'm a technology executive and an early adopter of technology. I started my own cloud company 5 years ago and have been involved in computer industry for 20, 30 years. So I kind of find myself as one of those people that actually adopts early technology. This bill is specifically addressed to at what's happening in the world. Available space on new cars often no longer allows for a front plate without compromising safety. My car, specifically, and there's a picture here, is a Model S Tesla. This is the current only model that comes out from Tesla, but they will be coming out with another version in 2017 that's a lot less expensive, $30,000-ish, that'll have the same safety features and perhaps even more. Now, the specific model that I had was produced in December of 2014. And what happened was that they added some more features of safety in the front, specifically a radar, which is denoted there. So previous model owners would be able to mount a bracket underneath the thing to put a front plate, which would actually partially obscure the radiator for the battery. There's a coolant for a battery. It doesn't have a normal battery, a normal radiator, because it doesn't have a motor. So previous owners would mount it there. Tesla has now put a radar there. What that has done is it's literally left zero space for putting a front plate. And so in order, you know, I'll kind of go through my testimony a little bit here. I got off. A lot of the crash avoidance systems now all require sensors, and these sensors are all over the vehicle and all sorts of different things in all different places. Specifically, there's infrared night vision systems, adaptive cruise control, lane departure warning systems, road edge barrier detection, pedestrian detection in darkness, animal detection with collision mitigation, large animal detection systems will actually do active braking if an elk goes in front of you, obstacle detection systems to notify a driver how close their vehicle is to an object, usually providing distance measurement to the inch and how close they are, anti-wrong way driver systems, automatic braking systems. All of these things require sensors on the front of your vehicle. Now, what's interesting about electric vehicles is that you no longer have a gasoline engine. So you no longer have this radiator that's in the front of a vehicle, and there's no need for it. So what the vehicle manufacturers are doing is they're diving the noses down to be more aerodynamic, and this is to save on fuel economy or electrical economy. And actually, the Department of Transportation actually has it's MPGE, so it's miles per gallon energy as opposed to miles per gallon for gasoline. So all of the manufacturers, whether they're gasoline vehicles or electric vehicles, are all trying to get things to be more efficient, to give them greater range for batteries and electric vehicles, and then with gasoline vehicles to give them better range. The other thing is you're trying not to also compromise safety and collisions. Now, Tesla is one of only a couple cars that actually gets 5-star rating from both Europe and the United States. They've done that because the way the front end is designed. And the way they design it is a very kind of gradual slope, but it kind of comes to a point like a bullet. And inside of that is all the design of the various different cross members and stuff so that you get fantastic crash resiliency. And this is mainly meant for occupant safety. Ultimately, all laws with regards to regards to motor vehicles on the road are pretty much aimed at vehicle safety and the occupant safety. And whether or not it's, you know, most actual deaths are actually pedestrian-oriented. And these sensors are some of that actually help the driver understand that. When we're driving on the road, if someone brakes in front of you, a warning sensor comes off and it warns you, beep, 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 and to slow down. And this is really helpful because there's so many distracted drivers on the road that aren't doing things that are, you know, when I learned to drive, no one had a cell phone. I mean, they weren't texting or anything like that. There are some legitimate uses, and I understand from a law enforcement perspective the need for a front plate. And not need. It's more of a want. And it helps with the vehicle identification. I think one of the things is that, you know, police officers or law enforcement use it for LIDAR detection. The headlight's just as good. In fact, it's probably even maybe better. I don't know. I've never used a LIDAR. The question here is, with technology changing, and we have one of the first vehicles like this where they're not going to put a front plate on it. They're not going to design these things that way. The safety and efficiency is more important than whether or not the city of Portland can, you know, write your parking ticket without writing out, going on the back of the vehicle and getting the plate number. So the question before the committee here is, do we as a society acknowledge the fact that technology is changing in the benefit of safety, and it outweighs the overall cost that, you know, a front plate wouldn't have? I submitted written testimony here, and you can go through. I didn't even kind of touch on the fact that, you know, front license plates create drag and what that actually costs in the society. And I've written it out here, and you can go ahead and read that. I did include two graphics with it. One of them is that there's 21 states that don't require front plates right now. They don't seem to have a law enforcement problem. In fact, most of the argument against doing away with front plates there has to do with tolls and being able to do optical character recognition on toll violations, and which is mainly a revenue thing. And I get it. They pay for the roads that way. We have gas tax. You know, two states in Massachusetts and Nevada have kind of a hybrid system. Nevada's law specifically says that and gives exemptions for when the manufacturer does not provide a place to put a plate, that you don't have to have a plate, which is very similar to this bill. And then Massachusetts, which is actually, does a very similar thing. And Massachusetts, incidentally, was the first state to ever have license plates. So they still don't require them, and they were the first ones to do it. And then there's a myriad of other states that just don't require them at all. Anyway, well, thank you for hearing us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Any questions for this panel?
Yes, for
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you. And thank you very much for taking the time to come out of the Capitol and testify and support your bill.
Sure.
Other than Tesla, do you know if any other manufacturers currently don't have a bracket for front plate?
That are electric?
Sure. Let's limit it to the bill, yeah. Which is electric.
Aside of Tesla in the bill for electric, no. I do know of other manufacturers that don't provide brackets for it. It's actually in part of my written testimony. I outlined with regards to fuel efficiency. The Mazda Miata actually has a 3.3% decrease in fuel efficiency by adding a front plate to it because they've designed it in such a way. And then the VW GTI actually loses as much as 16 horsepower by putting it, because the only place you can put it's in front of their radiator. Mm-hmm. And so it overheats the engine and reduces horsepower.
So, Mr. McGuire, how do other states that do require tolling deal with that?
That do require tolling?
The tolling issue. How do you get around the tolling issue? We do have a constrained budget when it comes to transportation infrastructure, so we don't toll in this state now, but there may be some point in the future where we do. How are other states dealing with that issue? Do you just get a pass
if you
don't have a front license plate?
No. Well, so what most tolls are actually done via what they call Easy Pass, which is an RFID thing. Now, sometimes those don't work. Sometimes people blatantly violate. Imagine that, people disobeying the law, and they'll run the booths. And so what they do is they use a system that takes a picture of the front and back and uses optical character recognition to do a comparison between the front and back to make sure that the plate is there. I would say it's very similar to photo radar systems we have here. They rely on the rear plate, not the front plate. Photo radar typically is aiming at the driver to get an identification on the driver versus the plate here. So I would imagine if you were doing a tolling system, that just do it that way.
Chair, I'll just add.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'll just add on your map, Florida is one of the states that doesn't require a license plate. They do, my in-laws are from there. We visit fairly often. They do extensive tolling across the entire state.
Different system.
And they do have that easy pass, and it is the RFID that's up in the up in your front of your window, and so they catch you as you're going through, and you don't have to stop and throw coins like the New Jersey Turnpike. So so it is completely all digital that way, and they seem to not have a problem with the front license plate issue.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have two other people signed up to speak. We have Captain Anderson and I'm not going to get this, Commander Ladd, thank you. Sorry, I'm not reading your handwriting well. Gentlemen, in no particular order, thank you for being here.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Anderson, and I am a captain with the Oregon State Police Patrol Division, and I'm here testifying in opposition to House Bill 2810. A bill that we feel ultimately, if passed, will reduce both the effectiveness and the efficiency with which law enforcement serves Oregon's citizens and visitors. There are many ways in which license plates contribute to law enforcement and the job that we do. They can range from as simple as a driving complaint, such as speeding, careless or reckless driving, DUII. And in fact, just a bit of information, the Oregon State Police received nearly 42,000 driving complaints in 2014 that were called into us from citizens using Oregon's highways. We also have hit-and-run crashes, fish and wildlife offenses, and major crimes. And at times, maybe you've seen it in the past, the major crime could lead to an Amber Alert where we have vehicle information up along the interstates, which includes the license plate number. So many times, or most times, information that comes into law enforcement with a vehicle description and license plate comes to us from a witness or a victim to one of the events I described. And if this bill passes and we were to reduce the number of vehicles registered in Oregon, albeit a small percentage or number of the total vehicles registered, we feel that we would have less information coming in that would include a license plate number. And I did get on the Department of Transportation's website and looked, and they estimate that by 2020, up to 20% of all new vehicles sold in Oregon could be electric. And that's a good thing. But we believe that this bill, if passed, and eliminates the requirement for the front plate, would reduce our effectiveness and efficiency. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Ladd. I'm the Enforcement Division Commander for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association as well as the Oregon Chiefs of Police. And we are, we are opposed to changes outlined in House Bill 2810. Like the captain said, the two plate requirement in Oregon increases law enforcement's opportunity to identify vehicles that have been used in criminal acts, Amber Alerts, and our ability to attempt to locate for DUI and reckless driving on Oregon roadways. Additionally, on the investigative side, video surveillance has become much more common. So we're seeing video surveillance in retail businesses like Target or Fred Meyer's, and we're seeing them in with our homeowners, some at their front of their garages. The plate recognition from this surveillance helps us identify suspects in solving crimes. Sometimes it might just be a partial plate from a vehicle parked along the street, but nonetheless, it does help us locate and identify those who are committing crime in our community. So with that, and seconding Oregon State's position, Oregon State Police's position, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police oppose House Bill 2810, and I'm available for questions if needed.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
For either one of you gentlemen, it's also, isn't it, an officer safety question? If you were not able to see a front plate, and perhaps that was a suspect vehicle in a serious crime, that it could be a problem for officers encountering that vehicle.
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes, it could be. Law enforcement receives quite a bit of information from a license plate that helps that officer to know more about these, in, in this case, it could be a suspect behind the wheel. Is the suspect wanted? Are the driving privileges suspended? Is it an armed career criminal? Those things can be provided to us through a registration and then a driver's license check if, in fact, the registered owner is the one behind the wheel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Yes, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question I have for either or both of you, so if we're already, they're already producing these cars that don't have front license plates, so how do you respond? So now they're driving on the streets, I assume. I have a friend that owns one of these, driving on the streets with a license plate. So what is the response, or is there a response until something happens, the fact that they don't have the license plate?
I'm glad. Madam Chair, Representative Lively. So it is a violation currently in Oregon to not have a front plate. So those, if that is observed during a routine patrol by any law enforcement officer, that law enforcement officer can stop the vehicle and take appropriate legal enforcement action, whether that's a citation or a warning.
Yes, Representative Lively.
So, and I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to understand. So you take that action and the warning, and so in theory they would have to put a plate on there. Is that, is that the ultimate end of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, yes, we want them to have the plate on there. I heard a question earlier about, are there other vehicles that do not have a front plate mm-hmm. bracket? I don't know of other electric vehicles, but there are. The most common one that I know of is the Corvette.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are aftermarket opportunities for both the Corvette and for the Tesla, as a matter of fact, to put a front plate bracket on the vehicle.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
And thank you, Chair. And again, this falls in the category of education. So we often see high-performance vehicles like this with plates in their front windshield. Mm-hmm. To clarify, does that satisfy the requirement?
Mm-mm. And I had to reach out to my traffic team sergeant this morning, but there was a case that came through Oregon that says it does not satisfy that requirement. So I will point out, Madam Chair and Representative Lively, back to your question, as an anecdotal story, my wife purchased kind of one of these higher performance cars recently from a dealership that did not come with the plate, and she was none too happy to return to the dealership and have the holes drilled in the front bumper. So those are solutions that can occur.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
And I've seen on websites where Teslas do have brackets that can be used to attach to the front of the vehicle. But my other concern is, we've had other issues like too well tinted of windows, and people have been forced, if I'm not mistaken, to get those changed, were they not?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So. Yes. I'm struck we may have Senator Thatcher and Representative Barnhart who may have somehow endeavored to solve their problem. I'm not quite sure what they have done to deal with this at this point in time. Interesting issue. I believe, Mr. McGuire, did you want to comment? I saw you kind of, if you'd like to come back to the podium, did you have something you wanted to add to this?
Sure,
please stay there, gentlemen. We may have questions for the three of you, and then we'll move on to our next bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wanted to get back to the thing with other people having solved this in Teslas. And that is true. People previous to the ones that were issued in December. In December, they added on, and in the picture you'll see it at the very bottom, they added on an active radar, which was right where everyone puts the bracket. So prior Teslas, which I think a couple House members have, that was actually true. The current versions, it's not true. And that's why this is being a problem. And I would imagine that in the future, this is going to get worse. They're going to add more and more sensors to this. And it's not just going to be Tesla. It's going to be other manufacturers. But I just wanted to, as a point of clarification, some Teslas, yes. Newer Teslas, no.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions for this panel? Very interesting issue. I do have one question. Very briefly, I see that 31 states display registration plates on the front and the back. The rest of them don't, and a number of them are in the South. What do all our law enforcement officers do in all these blue states that don't require them? How does that work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I haven't talked with them, but I imagine they find a way to work within the law.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Appreciate you being here this afternoon. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill, 2810, and open a hearing very quickly on House Bill 2261. And I believe we have Ms. Joyce to wrap up today.
Oh, boy.
She's back.
We haven't seen her in a while.
Where have you been? Merry-go-round. She just keeps coming back.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I'll try to keep this very short. This bill is recommended to you by the statutorily created task force on DMV customer service and efficiency. The idea here is that DMV offers very few services online. The main one is vehicle registration renewal. What we find, though, in surveys and data over the months is that folks get to the very end of their registration period. They haven't renewed. And so they go, well, I could renew online, but my tags won't come in time. So I better go down to DMV, get in line, take up space, do my renewal, get my tags right there and put them on, which is fine. But this is a way that the task force found where we could maybe encourage folks to go online anyway, renew that registration, order the tags. The tags typically come in something like 4 or 5 business days. But what you could do under the bill is take your receipt that prints out from the computer, put it in your glove box, and that's going to count for proof of vehicle registration. We think that's going to encourage some people to stay at home, do their registration online, stay out of the field office. It's a small efficiency, and that's what the bill does.
Ms. Joyce, I'm amazed because I've been doing this with my boat for a long time, and I didn't realize you couldn't do it with a vehicle registration. Mm-mm. So that's fascinating to me, and I appreciate you bringing the bill. Vice Chair Davis.
Yes, I have a number of long questions that should keep us another 20 minutes or so, but Amy, thank you for your testimony. Would you recommend that we add to the bill maybe taping the receipt over the existing expired registration?
Chair McEwen.
Because that might be needed for...
Representative Davis, I would accept that if you go over a speed bump, it can fall off.
Yeah.
And that's not...
Well,
good.
That's why we need to study.
That's right. That's correct. Yes. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you because I am one of the ones that forgets all the time, and I go online, and I've gotten the ticket, and then I've gone to DMV, and I've gotten the ticket and had to go in and then take in my receipt and show that I have my tags and get my ticket waived. And so this is a great one. Love it. Thank you so much.
A nice way to end our committee hearing this afternoon. Any other questions for Ms. Joyce? On that note, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2261. I have one announcement that I would make, and Ms. Joyce, you are excused, but...
You got her hopes.
Committee, this afternoon I was notified early this morning that someone who has been very near and dear to the transportation issues that face this state for a very long time passed away this morning. And it is Mayor Shirley Kalkoven from Nehalem. Mm. And she has been a stalwart in many aspects of transportation across this state for years and years and years. And she's been a stalwart supporter of her community of Nehalem. She's been very involved with the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Organization for years. She's been a caring and very talented and experienced servant of this state for a very, very long time. And I just wanted to note today her passing, and she will sorely be missed in the transportation community. And I wanted to just bring that to our attention today, as her community is very sad to be notified of her passing this morning. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to get that on the record today. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? And that we are adjourned. Thank you. Order. And that we are adjourned. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the